This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On ABC Listen.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Welcome to The Conversation Hour. It's going to be an eclectic show, shall we say. Everything from film talk to games talk to flower hunting talk. But first, I want to talk about a truly disturbing stat out today, and I'd love to hear your stories if you can join the conversation. Australia has recorded its deadliest year on record for drug overdoses, almost 2,600 deaths, one every 3.5 hours. And this is the thing, 80% were unintentional. It's a tough topic, but here's the thing, these are preventable deaths. And if you're thinking this is a wasted youth issue, think again. For the first time, people in the 50 to 59 age group recorded the highest number of unintentional overdose deaths. The majority of them men, the majority of them middle-aged. So what's going wrong? And what is the answer? Has your family or friendship group been touched by this? How did it happen? Did you or someone that you know come close to this worst case scenario? And what stopped it happening? Please join me in conversation. I'd love to hear your stories. Surely we can do better to prevent these deaths. So we're going to dig into that very soon on The Conversation Hour on 774 ABC Melbourne and Victoria. Also this hour, do you burp your house? Yes, burp your house. House burping, you've probably heard of it as a German and Nordic custom. It basically means opening up the windows, letting the air flow in. Maybe you do that without being German or Nordic. We're going to be talking about how to keep your house healthy in winter. What are your tips? What's your winter routine to keep the house nice and warm, but not so stuffy as to produce the mold and the bad air that makes us ill? We'll have an expert to tell us her tips, and you can call as well and ask your questions. I want to know from you, what do you do? And do you think that our homes, our Aussie homes, cope well with winter these days? Are we still building for the wrong climate? Maybe what have you done to retrofit a badly designed house? And also, later this hour, he's back. Yep, that's a jazzed up James Bond. Bond is jazzed up again, this time as a game. Not for the first time, a console game. Every time James Bond goes away, he is revived. James Bond as a character is 74 years old. As I say, now he's a console game. And we're going to get someone to talk us through that. Is it any good? How does James Bond actually transfer to a game? But I want to know from you, should the James Bond franchise just float away? Should we just live and let it die? Diamonds must be forever, but is it time to say Dr. No to James Bond? I want to hear from you.
This is The Conversation Hour with Mary Guerin.
So it has been a sobering report that was released today. It looked at the latest year of stats, which is 2024. And as I say, a record number of overdose deaths and 80% of them unintentional. Joining me now is John Ryan, who's CEO of the Pennington Institute that compiled this report. Thanks for joining us, John.
My pleasure.
A record year for overdoses. What was your reaction to finding that out in this report?
Oh, look, to be honest, I find it heartbreaking. I've been in this space for a long time, and I just think that it's extraordinary that these deaths are happening. As you say, 1 every 3.5 hours we're losing someone to overdose in Australia. And even with that scale of harm in the community, you know, it's double the road toll. We're not taking it seriously. I think that's the tragedy. What I find really shocking is that you know, we know that we've got the evidence about what works, and we just don't have an Australian government particularly that's willing to lean in and show some leadership in relation to it.
Yeah, definitely want to lean into what you believe is the thing, the simple things potentially that we need to do as a society. But I also want to hear from people if this issue has touched your life, what do you believe needs to be done as well? Before we get to the solutions, John, I wanted to dig into that stat that you highlight, that for the first time, the 50 to 59 age group is the largest group of unintentional overdoses. Is that right? What do your figures reveal about what is happening there?
Well, unfortunately, this is a snapshot report, so we've got a lot of data analysis to do in the following few months. Our view is that we should share this information as soon as possible. It is 2024 data, so it's already terribly old in my view. So this report doesn't actually explain why that age group is so high. But, you know, one of the facts of the matter is, you know, the overdose toll is actually contributed from a variety of drugs, both legal drugs, pharmaceutical drugs and illicit drugs. And you could imagine that people in that 50 to 59 group are actually, implicated in all of those various drugs. So I think it's just a reflection of how much drug use is prevalent across the community. The other big age range that saw a significant increase was people in their 30s. So it is really extraordinary to me that, it's not as in the US, it's especially people in their 20s, etc. We're seeing people in their 30s, but especially in their 50s, particularly vulnerable. But it's right across the age range, to be honest.
You're listening to John Ryan, who's CEO of the Pennington Institute. We're talking about drug overdoses and, I guess, particularly the unintentional ones. Tercy from Diamond Creek, or is it Teresa? You've called in. What did you want to say?
Oh, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. As a retired nurse for many years, I was working on the wards when particularly slow-release narcotics were released.
Mm-hmm. In medicine, Teresa?
In hospitals for management of pain.
Mm-hmm.
Back then, very few of us had little understanding of just how lethal these medications could be. And they are often combined with other medications such as barbiturates, sedatives, various
So Teresa, during your time there, did you sort of witness the misuse of these slow release narcotics?
It wasn't misuse. It was a lack of understanding that even if you give someone 10 milligrams of morphine, that will last them 12 hours. Who have never had morphine before, so they're called narcotic naive, they are going to react as like someone who's had a massive dose, for example, because they're simply not used to metabolising it.
Yeah.
And if you add that to some sort of sedative, the effect is amplified grossly. So I think that the real problem is a lack of understanding, particularly for people who are prescribed these slow release or even something like oxycodone.
Yeah. Teresa, thank you so much. Really valuable to get your insights, particularly that historical perspective, Teresa. John, you've been listening to Teresa there, and I'm getting some texts as well along the same lines. Are people overdosing on prescription drugs? Were you able to discover that?
Yes, so prescription drugs are absolutely central to this problem. There's a contribution from alcohol, a legal drug, but there's also a significant contribution from prescription drugs and illicit drugs. So it really is across the spectrum. I think that person, Teresa, was absolutely correct. There's a real lack of understanding in the community, and experts have the knowledge required, but it's not shared adequately across the community, and I think that's I appreciate governments have a lot of differing priorities, but what we don't see is proper education of the community to build community capacity to manage drug use issues, and at the worst case scenario, to identify and manage an overdose. We just don't have that strength and knowledge and capacity in the community, and that, to my mind, is a failure of government, because we've put so much effort into law enforcement. 2/3 of the budget goes to law enforcement. And about 1.6 goes to safety approaches or harm reduction. And that's that education that Teresa's talking about, that's absolutely part of the harm reduction possibility, but we're not actually resourcing it. So we're leaving the community in the dark and people are dying as a consequence.
You're listening to John Ryan from the Pennington Institute. We're talking about the level of accidental drug overdoses and drug overdoses in general. You're talking there, John, about the solutions, harm reduction and so forth. What specifically would you like to see? What would be, do you think, the most effective measures, apart from throwing more resources into it, as you say, that might, for instance, mirror what we do for the road toll?
Well, I think the resources are really important, because 2/3 of the budget to law enforcement, when we know that drugs are not necessarily illegal, so it's not a law enforcement, responsibility. But even so, cocaine and methamphetamine and illicit drugs are readily available. So we've got to boost the capacity of the healthcare system to deal with this. That means better funding for drug treatment. But I think most importantly, it means a proper education for the community. Those opioid overdoses, which is what Teresa was talking about, they're actually really easy to solve in an emergency situation if you know how to identify the overdose and you've got naloxone, the opioid overdose reversal drug, handy, and you know how to use it. Like, that's life saved.
So, John, does that come down to, if, for instance, if we're on a journey from illness and becoming addicted to potentially prescription drugs and so forth, is some of that awareness then about the treating medical officers? Is it part of that as well?
Yeah, there's been quite a bit of work, but not nearly enough in terms of healthcare professionals and drug dependence and drug-related risk. That's improved, I think, in the last 10 years. We haven't seen nearly the same level of commitment in relation to the broader community. But people do develop real risk from overdose because they've had a traffic road trauma, they've had an accident at work, they've had an accident at sport, they end up on high potency opioids and they don't know the risks that they're under. They haven't been properly explained to them, and then they add some alcohol in or they make a mistake with their dosing. So people are actually really vulnerable after medical care, and I don't think we're serious about that either, because we think that this is an illicit drug problem or even a young person's problem, and the data just doesn't back that up.
Just to go back to something that you were talking about there, this ability to reverse a potential overdose. What if someone is listening right now and they've got a loved one, or even they are using some of these drugs that carry risks, such as opioids and stimulants and cocaine as well? What are the practical steps? Let's set aside all of the talk about what's led to it and obviously structural issues that we should go to that prevent all this happening in the first place. But what are the practical things that someone listening should know right now in order to save a life?
The number one thing is, don't delay calling for emergency assistance. Don't delay calling 000, because time is absolutely everything in these situations. And, we're talking about fatal overdoses, but non-fatal overdoses can have lifelong impact, including acquired brain injuries. So the most important thing is 000, get help. The second thing is actually try and educate yourself on the signs of an overdose and the way that overdose risk can happen. And that, you know, one of the big ones is unusual snoring for opioid overdose. So if you're on high dose medications for pain relief and you're snoring unusually, you should be, your partner or parent should try and wake you up. And if they can't wake you up, it's triple O, it's an emergency. So that's a sign of overdose, but so is, depressed breathing. And if you've got the naloxone handy, it's not only triple O, but that naloxone will actually reverse an opioid overdose. And so, and naloxone is available in Victoria and increasingly available in Victoria. And so I'd really encourage people that are the family and friends or even people who are themselves at risk of overdose to get naloxone and make sure it's around for an emergency.
Naloxone. And this on text, John, from an anonymous texter. Narcan should be everywhere. I used to work in a public library and I carried it. I had to use it twice on people who came into the library and used more than they should. It should be free and taught to everyone.
Yeah, Narcan is the trade name for naloxone.
Right.
And it is free. The Victorian government's actually really stepped up in that regard and provided lots of different access points for naloxone. I'd really encourage people to use it. But we don't have an education campaign in the broader community. I mean, it's great to talk to you and to your listeners, but we actually need a government-led education campaigns around this, not the old fear-mongering, because that doesn't work, but, you know, really skilling people up and equipping them to understand what naloxone is, for example. Like, that is a piece of education that has not been supported by government.
Which government level is responsible, or are they all?
Well, they're all responsible, but the big failure, to my mind, is at the federal government level. You know, they've got an opportunity to show leadership. They certainly talk about these issues from an evidence-based perspective, but when it comes to, for example, the drug and alcohol program at the Australian government, their own independent evaluation said it should increase support for harm reduction. It's basically non-existent. And all they've done is, you know, put some, you know, I don't mean to be cruel, but a few weasel words in support of harm reduction is just not enough. It needs to be a core funding commitment. And at 1.6%, it's laughable in terms of the scale of the problem that we've got and the real emphasis that is, you know, the proof in the pudding is 1.6% of the funding. I mean, that is really unbelievably inadequate.
Yeah. John Ryan, I'm just going to put something finally to you. This is, I'm not sure how representative this would be, but it's the opposite, perhaps devil's advocate point of view. The taxpayer shouldn't be paying for opioid reversal drugs. Nobody forced these people to ingest substances. They're entirely preventable. This from a 25-year-plus emergency services worker and a couple of other texts along those lines. What would you have to say?
Well, I just, you know, I mean, I understand that point of view, but the sad fact is, you know, we have safety rails on the roads for people that are bad drivers or drunk drivers. Like, we do a lot of things to protect the vulnerable members of our community. And as frustrating as this is for some people that, you know, are completely not at risk themselves, the fact of the matter is we need to be caring for people that are vulnerable. And even if we want to be hard on those vulnerable people, we need to be caring for their friends and their family and their neighbours. Because the ripple effect of one single overdose is right throughout the community. And so even from a selfish perspective, from a money-saving perspective, if we follow the evidence, we will be actually providing the guardrails for people in the community.
John Ryan, thank you so much for breaking that down for us today.
Thank you.
John Ryan is CEO of the Pennington Institute. And I just want to put this out there, the National Alcohol and Other Drug Hotline is a free and confidential phone service that provides counselling and advice and information if you or someone that you know is struggling with addiction. And that number is 1800 250 015, so 1800 250 015. This on text as well. Peter's saying, look, people self-medicate with drugs to cope with trauma and disadvantage, so we need to attack that. And a lot of texts about mental illness. This from Marie. Hi, Mary. My brother died from an accidental overdose 5 years ago. He was 50 and had rheumatoid arthritis and was doctor shopping and buying medication online. The coroner stated he had a bad heart and took too much to sleep and did not wake up. It's a chronic problem. Definitely something that we should all be thinking about as a society and also perhaps for our neighbours and community as well. It's the Conversation Hour on 774 ABC Melbourne and Victoria. Keep those stories coming in. But now also, remember later on we're going to be asking you whether James Bond is a franchise that just should be, going faintly into the distance. Are we sick of him yet? He's a console game. Again, it's not the first time. I want to know your thoughts. But coming up next, do you burp your house? How do you keep your house healthy, particularly when it comes to winter?
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is the Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
So what do you do in winter to keep your home healthy or warm? Warm without being stuffy and mould-inducing? Does your home cope well with the winter, or are we still building for the wrong climate? I'd love to hear from you. 1300 222 774. And do you burp your house? Turns out one of the simplest things we can do for our health is to open the windows. Professor Rebecca Bentley is Director of Healthy Housing at the Melbourne School of Population and Global Health at the University of Melbourne. Hello, Rebecca.
Hi, Mary. How are you?
Good, thank you. You've done some research, well, for many years now, but what have you found recently about how Australians are sealing up their homes to stay warm?
Well, what we've begun to realise in our research, we've been very interested in how homes can become quite moist and damp inside and how that can then impact on health. And if we look at what's happening in Australia, there's a large focus on trying to keep homes warm in winter, and that's got sustainability purposes. So we want to keep our heating bills down. We want to keep our homes warm, but we don't always think about what that then means for the air quality in our rooms, and also what that then might mean for our health. So we've started thinking about, well, how can we balance out this aim of keeping our houses warm, keeping our energy bills down, but also keeping the air quality good in our homes.
And of course, something that's been a bit of a buzzword lately, or a couple of words, is house burping. Apparently it was Germanic and Nordic, but what does it really mean?
Look, it's really simple, and probably something a lot of people may be doing already, which is just simply opening windows and letting some fresh air in and letting the stale air out. So it's something that you can do just in short bursts that to sort of freshen up your home. And when it works well, it lets the moisture out, so you're actually heating drier air in your home, so your heating can be more efficient. So it's just this sort of simple idea of maybe twice a day letting fresh air in, the bad air out during winter, which helps with this idea of, well, we want fresh air, but we don't want to leave our house open. We can't keep it warm. Mm. But having said that, I mean, you do have to think about things like air pollution. If you live beside a road, then maybe you want to think about the times that you do it. If there's bushfire smoke around or burning off smoke, you know, maybe time it when there's not bad outdoor air as well. So it's not sort of completely simple, but in a way it is simple. It's just this idea that we can refresh the air in our rooms, and that has health benefits, but also potentially is an efficient way that we can keep our homes warm by letting some of that moisture out.
Fiona in Kensington says, just burped my house, opened all the doors and windows and let the breeze do the rest. This on text, I constantly open windows and doors to get fresh air in and always sleep with an open window. Rebecca, when I was reading about this house burping, some of those countries do take it to much more of an extreme than just twice a day, don't they? They talk about minimum number of hours at a time. You know, what are the general rules that you would think are about right in Australia?
Yeah, look, it does depend on where you live in Australia and your house. So I think it's hard to sort of set rules exactly, this is the thing you must do. But I think, you know, living in a house and starting to understand the airflow and whether you can get good cross ventilation means that maybe you could be more efficient, you know, that you can get sort of breezes through. But if you live in, say, a house where all the windows are only on one side and it's a little bit harder, then, you know, maybe you have to do it more often. So you could sort of set some rules, but I think it's something that people really need to understand their home and think about to do the most effectively.
Mm. Tell me what you've done with your house to keep it healthy, to keep the air healthy, and particularly if you've got an older house that might not have been built with that in mind, or even a newer house that wasn't built with that in mind. Rebecca, in Victoria, we've got new standards for particularly residential rental properties coming in next March. We were talking about this recently because rental places have much more mould in it, it's been found, than those owned by owner-occupiers. Those energy standards cover things like heating, cooling, draft proofing, ceiling insulation. Have you looked at those new standards and do you think they're good enough?
Yeah, look, I think the standards aren't bad, and it's really going to be about implementing them and having them, followed through so that people who have problems in their home can actually get action. It's going to be interesting to see how that sort of starts to unfold. I know that in the United Kingdom, for example, there's been fairly rapid shifts in terms of regulations around renters and housing and responses to mould that rose as part of a death of a two-year-old in 2022 in community housing in the UK. Mm. And they've seen a lot of, movement, and I think we're following that up to see, see the health benefits of that. And similarly, I think this might be about implementation here, that there actually is, a way to sort of get some of this change happening for renters. It is unfortunately true that the rates of mould and damp in rental properties in Melbourne is high. It's certainly something, that we need to act on. And so it's good to see regulations coming in.
Mm. And how that texter was talking before about sleeping with the window open, what's the evidence about whether that's good for you or not?
Yeah, this is an interesting one, isn't it? So It's not a straightforward question, in the sense that there's evidence to say that if you're in a cold room and you spend a lot of time in the cold, that's potentially bad for your health. Mm. But also you want fresh air in your room, and particularly at night, you don't want carbon dioxide building up in your room. If your room's all closed and your door's closed, that's a potential risk. So again, it's managing these dual considerations of temperature and fresh air. I think I err on the side of letting fresh air in. Most of the time, the temperature's okay and you can put covers on. But I think if it's a really, really cold night, or you might want to sort of think about it a little bit as well, and just open and close windows judiciously and let sort of some fresh air in and out.
I know that I can't fall asleep unless it's actually a cold room, so I guess there's a little bit of that as well.
Yep.
Linda, you're on the line from St Helena. What did you want to say?
Yes, look, I just said to Amber, look, I was just listening to your guests while I was, hanging out, washing and doing all this stuff, and I went back into the house and I opened up the front door and I opened up the back door.
Good on you, Linda.
Yeah. Very
inspiring. Does it feel better?
I feel so good.
Will you keep doing it through winter, do you think, Linda?
Can I say yes with permissions?
That's fair enough. We're not going to come and check on your doors, Linda. Thank you, though. So you're inspiring people already, Rebecca. The simplest thing that people can do right now as they're listening, or what other things can they do to help the air quality in their homes over the next few weeks, particularly not spending a lot of money, not thinking about putting, new vents in their houses and so forth?
Well, another simple thing that you can do is if you have a heating system that's got a filter in it, cleaning the filter, just making sure that it's running efficiently and that there's not a build-up of dirt and grit and mould and other things in the filter in your heating systems. So, for example, split systems, it's relatively easy to access and have a look at those and clean them. I think always using ventilation and fans when you're cooking in your bathroom is a bit of a no-brainer in terms of keeping moisture levels down in your home and keeping sort of that air quality as good as it can be. And just paying attention to, are there any parts of your house where you think there might be some you know, after a bit of rain, whether there's been a leak in the roof and there might be some damage and some water coming in the walls that you might need to fix. Because often fixing those problems sooner rather than later is a good idea as well.
Before I let you go, Rebecca, this on text, I live on a road with about 12 huge trucks a day delivering to the supermarkets, a lot of fine black dust. What you were talking about, this person is saying they're in a quandary about opening the windows and need some advice.
Yeah. Look, that's a really particular, very tricky situation. And I think if you've got a lot of, traffic outside of your house that's generating that kind of pollution, there's other things like mechanical ventilation that you can install in your house. And I don't know if that's an option, but you'd want to be more judicious about when you open windows in that situation. So maybe at night when there's less trucks around, but it is a real problem. So when you've got a lot of external air pollution, obviously this is an effective, simple technique of opening and closing your windows, gets a bit more complicated. And it's an unfortunate situation where we do have, homes that are along a lot of main roads, and it does make it a harder decision. And it's not just the pollution, it's also the noise from the traffic and the trucks that's a problem as well when you're opening and closing windows.
And just quickly, do air purifiers work? That's another question.
Yeah, air purifiers, if you get a good filter, they do actually work, and actually it is a good suggestion for the people who are on main roads with a lot of traffic. They can work. I guess the thing to say about them is they do generate a noise, and they obviously, draw on electricity, although they can be quite efficient as well. But it may be a good solution if you're in the sort of situation where opening and closing windows is a bit of a problem.
Rebecca, thank you for joining Conversation Hour today.
Great. It was nice to chat.
Yeah, Professor Rebecca Bentley, who is from the University of Melbourne, looking at that. Cameron says, we've got an old house and the airflow is great, even with all the windows and doors closed. And my German mum always said you need to let Frischluft, I've probably said that wrong, fresh air into your house every day. I still do this, much to the horror of my Scottish hubby, who complains of the cold. Laugh out loud. What do you do with your house? Do we just let all the air in? And tell me also, are you a citizen scientist? What's your greatest find? Soon we're going to be talking to a Frankston man who's an orchid hunter in his spare time, and he's discovered new species. I'd love to hear from you if you can match that. But next, James Bond is back again as a console game again. After more than 7 decades, I want to know from you, is it too much? Do you still love 007? Or do you have a view to kill the James Bond franchise?
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Yes, that's the James Bond theme, specifically recorded for the 1997 film Tomorrow Never Dies. Very, very jazzy. James Bond is always jazzed up. He just keeps coming back. Should we have the license to kill James Bond? I'd love to know from you. He's back, the character, as a game, and not for the first time. And Stephen Conway, who's senior lecturer and course director for games and interactivity at Swinburne University, has been checking it out. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, Mary.
So this isn't the first time James Bond has been a game, that's right?
Oh, yes, no. He's probably, we can go back 45-ish years, I think, to the first version. Yeah, so he's been around a long time in games.
Right. But this is a new release. What's it like?
It's pretty great. I mean, I have some misgivings, but that's more as a game designer than as a player, I suppose. So, look, it represents, I think, the IP in a fresh new direction. They used the right developers for it. It looks beautiful. It's very well acted by the lovely... I mean, the chap who's the James... But he's only the James Bond for the games, apparently. He's not going to be used in the film version that I think Denis Villeneuve is going to be directing. So we're going to have multiple Bonds, apparently, but this is acted by Patrick, I forget his surname, but he was in Dexter, Original Sin.
So it's a real actor in the console game.
Yes. So games these days use a lot of motion capture, voice acting. And so, yes, most games now, you actually just capture the actor performing their scene and then you just translate that into the game world.
So this is James Bond back. Tell me if you're tempted to go out and get that or to get it for someone that you love. Or should James Bond just go away? He is 74 years old as a character. I want your verdict. Is it time to say Dr. No to James Bond? Sarah in Southbank says, Mary, I've never watched a James Bond film. On principle, too sexist, just not interested in women being eye candy only. Sarah's vote is no. Stephen, do you think that James Bond is just, you know, an infinitely revivable character into the future?
Yeah, I think in a way, you know, Bond is a much more kind of liquid IP than kind of a superhero, which you don't only associate with a particular location, like Spider-Man, New York, has to have the costume, has to have specific powers. I think James Bond is a lot more malleable. But he's also, I absolutely agree, he's a product of a monoculture that, you know, we all used to kind of watch the nightly film on Saturday at 8 p.m. and we got exposed to James Bond because we couldn't choose what content we would consume. We turn on the television, a James Bond movie is on, what are you going to do about it? And so we've been exposed growing up, you know, I'm in my 40s now and I was exposed to that monoculture, but now we've got so many different modes of media consumption. My son, you know, I said, oh, I'm playing the latest James Bond game, and he just looked at me completely blank.
How old is he?
He's 9.
Okay.
And he could not care less. I was like, 007. And he's like, why are you saying random numbers? What is going on? You know? So he absolutely had no idea, you know, which is ironic because James Bond famously announces who he is to everyone in every movie, which is probably not good spycraft.
No, that's right. Like all the villains who give great detail about how they're going to kill him just to give him enough time to not be killed.
Exactly. So it comes from a very different production paradigm, a very different distribution paradigm where we had to see, you know, so Bond has to adapt to the new media environment. And I think Amazon are being quite savvy in beginning with a video game, you know, which is unprecedented, I think, to introduce what is a famous film character back to an audience, is to go via the game route rather than the film route. But I think that says a lot about their intentions, which I think is to capture a diverse set of audiences via what we call spreadable media, or, you know, transmedial storytelling. So we tell the story via the game, via the TV show, via the film, via the comic, and so on. And we try and capture as many different audiences as possible. And I think this Bond is very much speaking to a different audience. It's got Lana Del Rey, I think, is the opening prologue music. It's right. Got Lenny Kravitz. Lenny Kravitz plays a villain in it.
So is that enough to get the young players into it, do you think, Stephen?
I think it is. Good question. I think it is enough to bridge a gap between existing Bond fans and folks who've never heard of Bond but want a good action game. I don't think there's any value added, for example, by Lenny Kravitz. So I think he walks in and, you know, someone like myself in my 40s, I go, is that Lenny Kravitz? And then he does an absolutely terrible job of acting as a villain. It's honestly, it's awful.
Oh, come on. Are they all cartoonish? Are they really trying for something?
So he's not. That's exactly the problem. He's not. He just kind of, he's monotonous. He just kind of goes, hi, I'm a villain, Lenny Kravitz. And you're just watching it going, oh my God, put some, you know, oomph into it. Get villainous, Lenny. But no.
Well, there are some of us for whom Lenny Kravitz can't do anything wrong, Stephen, I've got to say.
I would agree until I saw this performance, and now I'm questioning a lot of life choices.
On text, Stephen, also had the View to a Kill game on the Commodore 64 back in 1986. This texter couldn't work out what to do, so I assumed it was a terrible game. But even so, anything on Commodore 64 was infinitely better than all these ridiculous games these days that just look like a badly filmed movie. Is that true?
Big call. I would say no. Absolutely not. Hey, look, the Commodore 64, you'll get no complaints from me. I thought it was a fantastic console, but, you know, GoldenEye, the better 64 was the Nintendo 64, and GoldenEye, I think, is an all-time classic on that, and that was quite filmic. And today, look, we just... You know, any media format these days is a convergence of various different media technologies, and games absolutely has taken that jug of film and poured it into games. And so, you know, yes, you do get these cinematic sequences that fall flat when Lenny Kravitz walks on the screen and monotonously delivers this line that is just awful. But you also get these really fantastic cinematic sequences that are very expertly acted and delivered and choreographed, and cinema, you know, the cinematography can be really exciting, because in a game engine you can put the camera wherever you want. So there's actually really exciting possibilities here. And I think the new First Light game does it really well in certain instances, and some of the acting is actually superb in the cinematography.
So they actually try and drag, you know, a fair bit of plot line in there as well. I mean, let's face it, James Bond plots, even if they're real life movies, aren't that deep either.
They are not, and this one is not. It is trying to be a bit more contemporary in drawing upon international political relations, conspiracy. You know, it is leaning a bit more into the Daniel Craig era Bond than a Pierce Brosnan or a Sean Connery, for sure. So he is still smarmy. He is still eye-rollingly kind of trying to be a bit of a womanizer. But it's very... self-deprecating, actually. It's very tongue-in-cheek. I think they're very aware of that sexist history, and they're trying to play with it. And so a lot of the women in the game are actually very empowered and very tough, and have their own agency. They're not relying on Bond to save them. They're not damsels in distress.
Okay.
They're very strong, powerful women. So it's actually very invigorating to play and go, they could have done the lazy thing, but actually they've aimed higher. So I will definitely give them kudos for that.
So when Mike texts in and says, I'd love to show my kids the movies due to the action and storylines, but I feel the way women are portrayed isn't up to current day values, and I don't want my daughter to feel objectified and my son to treat women the same way. Would you say to Mike, well, at least you might be able to play the game?
Yeah, I would absolutely recommend the game on that basis. I think the game does a really good job. I can think of at least three women characters in this game that are extremely well articulated and powerful when they don't rely on... Actually, in fact, two... I'm not going to spoil anything, but they save Bond more than he saves them.
Yeah, okay.
So it's actually an inversion of those power roles, which is really interesting. So I would absolutely say the game is what you want if you are tired of those tropes.
Julie in Perth says Lenny Kravitz is not in his 40s. He's 62. So maybe that gives him an excuse, Stephen.
Yeah, I know, maybe. maybe, you know, you can still put some oomph and some cartoonish villainous delivery behind. I mean, he's a pop star, right? How does he not have the charisma? I don't know either,
Stephen. I'm going to have to check it out to make sure. Stephen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Stephen Conway is from Swinburne University and looks at all these games and interactivity. And this on text, honestly, I think you need to lighten up. The recent Bond movies with Craig have been incredible and fun. Can't we just relax and enjoy something without analysing it to the nth degree? There's a vote to keep James Bond going. Okay. Oh, okay. He keeps getting back up. Let's face it, that's pretty good, isn't it? You're on The Conversation Hour on 774 ABC Melbourne and Victoria. Now, if you're a citizen scientist, if you go out there and you are contributing in your spare time to the science, well, you're going to be absolutely inspired or envious of my next guest. He is indeed a beer microbiologist by day, and when he's not doing that, he's discovering new species.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Robert Mitchell is an orchid hunter extraordinaire, and he joins me now. Hello, Robert.
Hi, how are you going?
Yeah, good, thank you. Now, you have apparently been searching up so many orchids that you have actually discovered new species. Let's step back a bit. You, by day, are a beer microbiologist. That's your day job. How did you get into hunting orchids?
Well, I've always been a little bit of an outside sort of naturalist person. I sort of was in Scouts, and then I used to be in the outdoor club at Monash, and have sort of been interested in anything in the natural world. And coming into COVID, being a photographer, I was sort of looking for something to do. At the time, I was living in Frankston, where it's a really good area that lots of reserves where you have lots of different orchid species. And sort of was during that period that I managed to get into hunting orchids, I guess you'd say.
Hunting orchids. Why orchids?
Well, orchids are really fascinating. They're one of the most sort of diverse and interesting types of plants that we really have. You know, you think about eucalyptus trees, there's, you know, might be hundreds of different species, but they're all quite similar. With orchids, the flowers they produce range from something that looks like a flying duck to spiders to the ones I'm looking at, the sun orchids, where they're only open for maybe a few hours a day every few years. And so it's with so many species, I think there's maybe 400 different species in Victoria. It's like a really fascinating topic to look at.
Wow, 400 in Victoria alone. Tell me, if you are at Robert's level, if you're a citizen scientist, what do you aspire to do? What's your biggest find? 1300 222 774. And tell me about the species that you discovered, or at least you haven't been able to identify. Does that automatically mean you've discovered new species?
No. So one of the things about the sun orchids, the Thalamitra species, is they're very hard to tell apart from each other. They all have a very similar sort of, you know, they've got a single leaf. They might have between 1 and 10 flowers. And the group I look at, which is what they call the Porciflora complex, they are self-pollinating species. So they don't even open every year. They might actually just go to seed by themselves without ever opening.
Mm.
And so they were actually overlooked and all sort of lumped together into one species until 2004, when Jeff Jeans at the Botanic Gardens went and basically reclassified them. So it has now gone from one species to like 40 species now.
Right.
And so because they're so hard to study, there's still quite a few of them around that have been overlooked. And they range from ones that will practically grow as weeds. You might find them wandering around a drain or something like that, to ones that will grow in a really specific climate and location where they have these, what they call mycorrhizal associations, where they will only grow with specific types of fungus. And without that fungus, they can't grow. And so, you know, it's quite often that you get some common species you might actually find at the edge of a reserve or a football oval or something like that. But these rarer species might be just, you know, one small area. In terms of the new species I managed to find, I basically found three new species to science.
Three?
Which is three in total. And then I found two new species for Victoria. So they'd been recognised in South Australia, but they hadn't been recognised in Victoria before. And I managed to find those growing on the Mornington Peninsula.
Do you get to have your name them named after you?
So I got to name three of them, so the three new species.
Oh, what did did you go crazy with the names?
A little bit. So I've tried to keep them, you know, not too out there. So one of them's called Thalamitra serpentina, and so that comes from the name serpent. So it's actually got what they call the postamphylode. So this is the reproductive organs of the orchid. This sort of forms this interesting looking structure, and with Thalamitra, that's what you look at for identification. And this one sort of looks like a snake's head. So it's like, you know, tapers in, and it's got these trichomes that sort of stick out like a tongue.
Okay. So
the next one, a little bit drier, Thalamitra asperifolia. And asper means abrasive, and folia means leaf. So it's just got these sort of fine abrasive textures to the leaf that's quite unique.
Yep.
And did you have a question? Or?
Oh, I was waiting for you to go for your three. But honestly, none of them are called what I would have anticipated if I were doing it. Thalamitra, you know, Robert Mitchell. I would definitely be doing a Thalamitra Mary Guerin if I got to do that.
Yeah, so it's a little bit sort of, you know, not it's sort of frowned upon to name them after yourself.
Oh.
So people will sometimes like name them after their brother or whatever. And the last species actually I have named after a person, which is Thelemytra aurori, which is named for the Norwegian artist Aurora. So that's she's actually okay. My favourite artist. So.
Oh, there you go.
Ironically, the flower kind of resembles her a little bit. So most of these little sun orchids are blue coloration, or blue sort of purplish coloration, but this one's white.
Yeah.
And it has these little trichomes, a little sort of tufts and they're pink.
Yeah.
And these ones are pink. So like Aurora, no, she's pale, she's white. It's also a really small species. So it's just the perfect sort of species to name after her.
I've got this on text that someone who loves orchids, so there's some inspiration for people who want to go out today and find Robert Mitchell's three new species as well. How many hours a day do you spend, Robert, doing that?
Well, it tends to be concentrated during orchid season. So some orchids will start flowering winter, like things like the greenwoods have started flowering now, and helmet orchids.
Mm-hmm.
And then through spring is the main period, so... sort of from September through November is the most busy period for orchids. And I'm actually with the Australian Native Orchids Society. So we sometimes run trips doing things like searches to try and find species that might be lost or just going to an area to sort of see what's there. So that's a good group to join. Of course, I should mention the Botanic Gardens Orchid Conservation Group. So they're the ones that are doing all the
they
protection.
They would be loving you. Robert, thank you so much for really embodying the citizen scientist ideal there. Happy hunting.
Nice. Thank you.
That's Robert Mitchell, orchid hunter extraordinaire. Mark from Bentley East, what do you think about James Bond? Do you think it's time for that to live and let him die?
I think it's time to knock him off.
Why?
Mary. I've been a James Bond fan since I was 12 years old, which is a long, long time ago. And I think if you're going to kill a character off in the last movie, which they did, sorry for the spoiler alert if anyone hasn't seen the movies.
Uh-oh.
But, it's time. You know, there's other movie franchises out there that can fill the gap. And I think it's time to let it go.
Oh, Mike, that's really funny. Yes, it's been out for a while, so I don't think it's spoiler territory here. But Daniel Craig did say in one interview, "He's dead. How many times do I have to blow him up? He's dead."
Exactly. Yeah. Well, and I think it's time. It's like it. I think Daniel Craig brought a whole different type of character to the last couple of films, and I think it was a fitting end. And look, if you looked at it in real time. Timeline. I mean, considering the first film came out in the 60s, he'd be about 110 by now.
Exactly. Well, I figured out the character's 74, so he probably should stop jumping off buildings. Mark, thank you for your vote. I'll be back tomorrow.